Welcome back to the podcast. Today I'm joined by Dr. Dwayne Bratt, who is a professor of political science at Mont Royal University in Calgary. We have our second Albertan on in, I think, as many weeks. Dr. Bratt, it's wonderful to have you here on Decouple. Thanks for making the time.
Oh, happy to be here, Chris.
It's okay if I call you Dwayne or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's where my mama calls me.
Okay. Well, Dwayne, you're the author of two books. You kindly sent me this one here, The Politics of Can-Do Exports, but also this one here, Canada, the Provinces, the Global Nuclear Revival. Awesome books. The only problem I have is the binding is just terrible. Chunks.
Yes, the binding with McGill Queen's University Press. Yes, it's not very good. But the U of T Press one is much better.
So the binding, not so good. The content, excellent. And, I really regretted not having picked these books up earlier. I gave a talk to the Minerals Council of Australia on the topic of, how Ontario decarbonized. And, I had a bunch of facts from conversations with some very well-informed people, but a great resource. A fascinating time capsule as well. So you published Canada, the Provinces, and the Global Nuclear Revival in 2012. On our last episode, I was reflecting with James Krellenstein. We're talking about this current moment, and everyone seems hesitant to call it a renaissance because I think people were really burned by that language back in the early 2000s. And we were reflecting actually on how good things would have seemed around 2005, 2006, even compared to now. I mean, I would say 2018 was a real low point. We had, a lot of projects that were just not moving well, the EPRs in France, the AP1000s in the US. We have this glut in natural gas prices. We had the Fukushima hangover. And so things feel great right now. But, again, back in the noughties, as we call them, in the UK sphere of influence, the early 2000s, things looked pretty good. You wrote this, I guess, probably over a few years. Let's time travel back to when you wrote it, why you wrote it, and I don't know. We'll explore some of the lessons therein.
Yeah, in a sense, you can't understand the second book without the first book, and the first book actually started as a master's thesis in the early 1990s. Then I kind of put that to a side. And did a bunch of other projects and got my PhD. And I thought, no, I've got some stuff here. And then one of my colleagues at the University of Calgary had some really good files around the sale to Argentina and South Korea. And I thought, no, I've got some additional material. Let's finish this, put it to bed. And then when I finished that book, it was like, I have nothing more to say. I've done this job. And I can vividly remember sitting in the car with my wife in Calgary and a news program comes in about this Calgary entrepreneur looking to build a nuclear power plant in Alberta. She looks at me, goes, "Did you know about this?" I go, "No." And she goes, "Well, how many nuclear experts are there in Alberta?" And I made some quip about, "You mean outside of this car?" And I realized that there was something else here. So it actually started with that. And there was so much optimism when I started the project and what we were seeing. We were seeing the beginning of the first CANDU refurbishment in New Brunswick. There was plans for a new build in Ontario, Saskatchewan. Brad Wall comes to power, and he's incredibly pro-nuclear and creates this uranium development partnership. You got Hennessy, who was not a nuclear guy, was just a basic entrepreneur, which we have lots of in this province, looking at it. But by the time I finished the book, a lot of that optimism was gone. So it was a capsule in time. I think some stuff did occur, but not nearly what was expected at the time. Fast forward to today, there is a lot more going on, and not just talking, but actual multi-billion dollar projects. And just this week, the announcement that Pickering B is going to be refurbished in addition to Darlington and in addition to the SMR fleet in Darlington. And so there's so much more activity going on now than there was 10, 15 years ago, despite that optimism, which is why I think people are a bit gun shy, to use that word, revival or renaissance today.
Right. No, I mean, I think it's very, very important. I've learned over the years in clinical practice and outside as well to be super aware of what your biases are, the lenses through which you see the world, how they're distorted. We all have them. And, I hate to say it, but I tend to be a bit of a pessimist. So thank you for brightening my perception of where we are at the current moment with your perspective from back in the day. It is a fascinating element of the story that, we have this reactor design that we dreamed up, and that came out of, I think a lot of, nuclear advocates and industry folks probably don't like to talk too much about what the kind of original nuclear research that was going on up here was, whether it was the Manhattan Project North or not. But certainly, that it was the war. We didn't want Hitler to get the bomb first. And there was a massive investment in North America in trying to get there first. So could you tell me a little bit about just sweeping way back in time? And I think you covered this in the exports book, but about some of that history.
It's an absolutely fascinating story of how Canada ended up on the ground floor of the nuclear sector. And, we had the first country outside of the U.S. to have a functioning reactor, to have nuclear fission. And a lot of it was because of the threat to Britain. And so the British scientists came to Canada because we were still much more closely aligned with Britain in the 1940s than we are, for example, today. And so we had this influx of British scientists combined with European refugees from Germany, from France, who joined that team, came here. So it was considered a safe place to work. And they set up a lab in Montreal, plus our uranium deposits. And at that time, it wasn't about northern Saskatchewan. It was northern Ontario. It was Elliott Lake. And so they created this lab. It was in partnership with the Americans. So the Americans had a couple labs. We had the one in Montreal. And we're all working together on a weapon system, to get it first before the Germans did. But even during that time, all the participants, and the British included, were all thinking, what happens next? They all saw that this had huge civilian capabilities. And where the can-do comes about is General Groves, Leslie Groves. And if you remember the old movie, Paul Newman plays him, Fat Man and Little Boy. Groves is the military person, absolutely paranoid about secrecy, and he unilaterally ends all cooperation with the Canadians and the British in the middle of the Manhattan Project for about a year, maybe a bit less than a year. And it wasn't until the Atlantic Summit and Churchill and Roosevelt and King all agree on this. And then that brings everybody back together again. But what happened in that time period is the Canadians started doing independent work from the project. And that's the origins of the heavy water reactor system that would become the CANDU, was in that small window where you had all of these scientists, you have ended the cooperation with the Americans, but they don't put their tools down and they don't put their pencils down, and that they continue working and create this. And there's an irony here that Groves was concerned about creating not just secrets leaving. They were, even though the Soviets were an ally, they were very suspicious of the Soviets, but they created a competitor, a civilian competitor, because of his actions, which I don't think he recognized at the time. So it is a fascinating story. And the other aspect of this, which I touch on, is there was no debate either in Canada or in Britain to pursue the bomb. In Britain, it was just assumed that they were going to get their own bomb because that's what great powers did. In Canada, it was just assumed we were not going to pursue the bomb because we were not a great power, and therefore we put all of our energy into the civilian process. The British screwed up their civilian process because I think they put so much energy. They gas-fired cooling system, that the Magnox reactors just did not work very well. And I think it's because there was a disconnect between the military wing and the civilian wing. Canada, we didn't have that. But people have tried to go through the archives to see where the cabinet made this decision, where this debate occurred. There was no debate. We just naturally assumed we weren't going to do that. And our focus was on civilian energy.
Right. I mean, this heavy water story is fascinating. We have covered it quite a while ago with Jeremy Whitlock, who's a great guy over at the IAEA involved in anti-proliferation.
Yeah, Jeremy's great. Yeah, he's sharp.
And so, I mean, the story of the heavy water war, you know, this plant in Norway, I think it was a hydroelectric facility that they were making heavy water at. I'm not sure what the purposes were at that point, but certainly the German bomb program with Heisenberg was heavy water based. And the way that the heavy water, as Norway was being invaded by the Germans, was secreted out, I think, first through France and decoy boats and ships and things like that, getting it over to England. And is that where the heavy water that we used, you know, in the Montreal lab and later at Chalk River came from?
I believe some of it did come from that because, you know, heavy water does occur naturally, but in very, very rare circumstances, and it needs to be constructed. And in fact, one of the reasons we pursued heavy water was to use natural uranium, that it didn't require the enrichment capacity that the Americans did, which again is also tied into the bomb program. And so it was a nice mixture. But yeah, the story of Norway and how they got the heavy water out of Norway, you know, with the Nazis one step behind them, is it's a thriller. And there actually was a mini series on Netflix about that was quite entertaining.
I totally agree. And just before we kind of move on closer towards the present, I just think this origin story is fascinating. I mean, heavy water was used, I think, in the production of some of the potential bomb material that went into Little Boy and Fat Man. Maybe I'm off on that. But I think the Hanford reactors for plutonium production in the U.S. were also heavy water reactors. So there is this, you know, while Canada went the civilian route, and we know later on with the exports of some technology in collaboration with the U.S. to India, that led to a proliferation issue there. I'm just wondering if we could explore that a tiny bit more.
So there is a lot of discussion about whether the CANDUs, because of their design, are a greater proliferation risk than a light water reactor. I've looked at that. I'm not convinced of that. I think both of them have potential flaws that can lead to proliferation. Both of them have safeguards that are inherent in the system. And it depends on where you're coming from. So if you're an anti-nuclear activist and you're based in Canada, you get fixated on, you know, the refueling capability of heavy water, you know, the ability of natural uranium, the mixture with plutonium, and you ignore the light water proliferation risk. Likewise, if you're an activist in the United States, you do the exact opposite. So I'm not convinced it's actually, and I've never believed that it's a technological issue. It is, in fact, a political issue around proliferation. And I make this clear to my students. And I give this line about, well, the first country to develop a nuclear weapon was a third world country. And they all kind of look at me and go, yeah, but wasn't that the United States? I said, yes, it was. But if you look at the level of technology the Americans had in the 1940s and compare it to today, I've got more computing power in my phone than the Americans did in the 1940s. So it's not a technological problem. It's a political problem. And so focusing on a reactor design, if you wanted to build bombs, it is so much easier and simpler just to go and build a bomb than try to divert spent fuel from a reactor and convert it into weapons-grade uranium or weapons-grade plutonium for a bomb. They do that for political purposes, not for cost or technological purposes. They do it to mask what it is that they're doing. And quite frankly, we did see a lot of that in the 1950s and 60s with countries using civilians' energy as a mask to get to a weapon system. But they also discovered, as the Brazilians did and the Argentinians did, just how difficult and complicated it is.
Yeah, I mean, there's the difficulty of actually making the device, and then to be able to have the threat of deploying it, you know, the nuclear triad, what submarines, missiles and aircraft delivery, and then the ability to, you know, respond back. If it seems like that became too costly, as you said, for Brazilians, Argentinians, the Swedes, a whole number of countries had weapons programs they abandoned, and we're left with what I think 7 nuclear nations, or
we've got 9 right now. You know, we've got the 5 big countries that were part of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty: the Americans, the Russians, the Chinese, the French, and the British. And then since then, you've got India, you've got Pakistan, you've got North Korea, and you have Israel. Israel's never officially tested. But it's well acknowledged that they have they have the bomb. And I mean, North Korea has basically starved its people to produce a bomb. So it's not technologically sophisticated to do now. You just have to have the political will to do it. And the Iranians are working really hard at it, but they're facing sabotage and other domestic problems in that country as well.
Right. So getting back again to the pursuit of this CANDU reactor design, I'm thinking, you know, in the U.S., the first commercial nuclear power plant, I believe, Shippingport, and that came out of the nuclear propulsion system with Rickover and sort of settled in on the PWR, and I guess later the boiling water reactor came along. The Brits, were their first reactors Magnox gas reactors? And then the Soviets,
yes.
I'm just trying to put this all together. Were they RBMKs or... It sounds like there was a number of designs that proliferated. And then
there were a lot of different designs because it was right at the beginning and everybody was experimenting on the best way of doing things. And especially with the countries that had a weapons program like the British and the Russians, you know, that's where they went about doing it. What is more fascinating, I think, is the French and how they kind of combined American technology with German technology, in addition to their own pursuit of, you know, the force de frappe, their own independent nuclear weapon system as well. And so what makes Canada unique amongst all of these countries in the 40s, 50s, even into the 60s, is we were only working on the civilian side. We were not working on the military side. And so there was no crossover there. In fact, our military process ends, you know, in 1945.
And, you know, not that we should feel sort of too noble about that, because I think as your book explains, Canada did host U.S. nuclear weapons on Canadian missiles and also just full-on U.S. nuclear weapons delivery systems, I believe Newfoundland and elsewhere.
Yeah. Up until, you know, the late 70s, you know, we historians often talk about the great battle that brought down the Diefenbaker government in 1963 over hosting American nuclear weapons on Canadian soil. But in fact, it remained for years after that. And I would even make the case now, we're still protected by the American nuclear umbrella, even though there's no weapons on our soil, and which the Indians are quick to point out, you know, some of the hypocrisy that Canada has given to the Indians and the Pakistanis, saying, yes, but you are also very well protected there.
Right. That's interesting. Okay, this is going to be a slight tangent, and we can snuff it if we have to. But, you know, in terms, again, of talking about nuclear weapons and delivery systems, you know, Canada developed the CANDU reactor. This is one of, you know, been rated one of our top 10 engineering achievements. Another one of those top 10, I believe, was the Avro Arrow. It was widely recognized as being the world's best fighter interceptor at a time in which we wanted to get up to like Mach 2, Mach 3 to, I think, you know, intercept those Russian bombers before they came over. is that a true narrative that part of, you know, there's many reasons and hypotheses why the Abra era was scrapped, but one reason was because we're thinking that the delivery systems are now ICBMs or intercontinental ballistic missiles rather than airplane delivery.
Yeah, it was where that was moving, and it was going to missile systems away from fighter planes. It was also the issue of cost. There is so much mythology around the Avro Arrow, and there remain, people whose hobby it is, you know, just to study the Avro Arrow. But the linkage between the CANDU and the Avro, I think, is very important. Because when they shut down the Avro Arrow, and that may be very well justified based on cost and the changing nature of future warfare, it's where those scientists and engineers went. Many of them ended up in NASA. Many of them had to leave the country and work elsewhere because there was no work for them to do here. Why that is significant is that memory has been linked back to the CANDU, that we don't want to repeat what we did with the CANDU scientists and the CANDU engineers and the CANDU technology with what we did with the Avro Arrow. And so we often talk about mythologies, which are not true, they're not false, it's belief systems. And that belief system has been very powerful. And that if you walked into a cabinet room and you know we're making the pitch for further investment in the CANDU and export support and R&D, all you had to do was bring up the memory of the Avro Arrow. And so regardless of whether the Avro Arrow decision was correct or not, and I tend to be on the side of the historians that say, yes, it was the right call, that's not the way the public viewed it, and it's still not the way it's viewed today.
Right, right. Well, we're going to get to that because, your book in the Ontario chapter does discuss the potential new build, or potential as it was when you wrote the book, new large nuclear at Darlington, in that period of sort of 2008 to 2013. So we're going to touch on that, and we're going to touch on the sort of technology selection and arguments about whether we should have gone with a foreign reactor technology or stayed Canadian. But before we get there, I want to set the table a little bit more. When I gave that talk in Australia, Dylan Moon, who consults with me, pointed me towards some really interesting graphs of the price of coal after the OPEC crisis. Obviously, price of oil went through the roof, but we were still, some countries were burning oil for electricity, and there was a shift to coal and probably other reasons why coal got expensive. But it seems, when I look at nuclear, I'm avidly pro-nuclear, but I think I'm not delusionally pro-nuclear. It's a really hard technology. It requires the best of the best. Maybe it requires some people coming into the Avro program to help get it launched. But it's hard, and it's easier to do other things. And you only do nuclear if there's really an imperative there. And usually it's an energy security situation. And so France, obviously heavily dependent on oil for electricity production after OPEC, went nuclear. And it was interesting seeing that story in Ontario. And you touched on it a bit more in terms of where we were getting the coal from to fire that coal fleet we had, and some of the pragmatics of why Ontario in particular went nuclear. Can you expand on
that? There's so many comparisons to the decision of France to go nuclear, the decision of Japan to go nuclear, and the decision of Ontario to go nuclear. And it was all about energy security. Security in the sense of supply, and as well as security of price and the volatility of price. So France and Japan really ramped up post-OPEC. France relied on the uranium deposits of its former French colonies in West Africa. Japan has nothing. They don't have gas. They don't have oil. They don't have coal. They don't have uranium. But they figured that because of there's less volatility with the uranium price as it relates to nuclear energy than it is with a gas plant. And that's why Japan went there. Ontario made almost the same rationale and decision, but it was about coal. Ontario had already tapped out much of its hydro, even though they kept calling it Ontario Hydro. There wasn't much more hydro after they tapped Niagara Falls and some other areas. So they were relying heavily on coal, but there's no coal in Ontario. So the coal was either coming from Western Canada, or it was coming from Cape Breton, or was coming from the United States. Well, to get it across, you're dealing with the Great Lakes, and you know, it was a hell of a lot colder back in the 1950s, and the Great Lakes would often freeze over, and it was tough getting access there. And the Americans, the coal mining union was so powerful in West Virginia and Kentucky, there would be frequent strikes. So there were shortages of getting coal to Ontario. And Ontario had this burgeoning manufacturing sector in steel, and particularly automobiles. And to keep that electricity flowing, they needed a different source. That's why Ontario went nuclear. So you've got the situation of the Montreal lab. So the infrastructure is starting in Montreal, but very quickly, everything moves over to Ontario. And that's why to this day, Ontario is the heart and center of the nuclear industry in Canada, because of the decisions that both the Ontario government and the Canadian government made at the same time to develop nuclear in the province of Ontario because of the issues with coal.
I mean, there's parallels there. I've spoken with some experts about China's rationale for nuclear. They have a lot of coal, but it's in the wrong place in the country. It's off in the Northwest, and their population centers are on the coast of the Southeast. And I think it was something like 50% of all rail traffic was just moving that coal around. So a huge expense there. So that's interesting context. You know, we had this coal phase out much publicized between 2005 and 2014. It's been called North America's greatest greenhouse gas reduction. You know, we had massive problems with air pollution, certainly partially from the automobile sector, but the coal didn't help. Ontario Medical Association said 1,900 premature deaths per year as a result of that air pollution, which coal contributed to. And it's much celebrated, but a lot of people scratch their heads and they go, well, hold on, you didn't build any new nuclear reactors during that time. But, you know, for me, looking at back into the history, I say, well, the coal phase that began in 19, I'm trying to think when Douglas Point came online, but probably we should probably talk more Pickering. Pickering was built instead of a coal plant. Can you talk a little bit about that? About, you know, again, so this idea, yes, of the coal phase out.
There was a coal phase out, but they fixate on the final ending of the plants. Ontario had actually been phasing out coal probably since the late 60s and definitely the early 70s when Pickering A came online, because you didn't need as much coal. And so the percentage of coal was dropping. It was only in the McGuinty years that they finally got rid of the last plants. And so the final coal phase out, which people get fixated on, they often say it was due to renewables. It was due to the rise of wind, because there was an increase in wind going on at that time. But no, it was the restarting of the reactors that had been temporarily shut down by the Harris government in 1997. It was the restarting of those nuclear power plants that allowed the McGuinty government to do so. And when you listen to Jerry Butts, people often say, well, Butts was principal secretary to Trudeau, which he was, but he was also very highly involved in the McGuinty government. Butts is quite honest. He says it was nuclear energy that allowed us to do the coal phase out. So the coal phase out went on for multiple decades, and it was all due to nuclear energy. It was not about wind. It was not about solar. It was not about gas plants. It was energy, both the building of Pickering and then the restarting of Pickering and Bruce in the early 2000s.
Do you know any of the details around that actual deal? As I understand it, when Ontario Hydro built Pickering, some of the budgeting and costing had to do with being price competitive to coal. Do you know any of those details? Or
don't know about those, but I think they were less focused on the whether they had to subsidize the nuclear power plant, because this was about subsidizing electricity to the auto sector, right? And you know, I think there's a reason that Pickering was built in Pickering when you've got the massive GM plant in Oshawa, right? And so I don't know about the linkages with cost with coal, because it wasn't just the cost of coal. It was the reliability of getting coal supplies by train, by boat, dealing with American strikes, what have you.
So this was very fascinating for me, but obviously there's been this sort of yo-yo and dance. You know, we had a lot of nuclear online and something went sort of terribly wrong in the 90s. You know, you mentioned the shutdown of Bruce A and I guess Pickering A. Tell me a little bit more about that period, because right now, you know, the nuclear sector has a lot to celebrate, amazing operations. You know, we've been celebrating the Pickering refurbishment. They got the World Association of Nuclear Operators, you know, A plus or level one. So they're doing a fantastic job running that plant, but things looked grim in the '90s. Tell me why and tell me the details.
There was an absolutely scathing report that came out, looking at some of the issues about the Bruce and Pickering facilities in the late 1990s to the Harris government. And it was sort of ad hoc modifications to designs that had been occurring over multiple years. There were workplace issues, literally people, you know, showing up, operators intoxicated and drug issues and every possible thing that you could have happen, which was affecting the performance and the concern about potential safety. And so they quickly shut down a third of the fleet, the oldest of the reactors. And it was a really gutsy call by the Harris government to make, but I don't think they had much choice given public pressure that was facing them when these reports came out, and they commissioned additional non-Canadian nuclear experts to come in to talk about these things. But they didn't dismantle them, and they didn't decommission them, and then they made the decision that they were going to restart these with additional work and these sorts of things. But the other thing that they created was Bruce Power. This was a really important decision because it created competition within the nuclear sector. So even though Bruce remained the reactors were owned by the Ontario government, by bringing in a private sector operator, it forced competition with what would become OPG, because they gave a contract to Bruce and said, if you can, you know, fire these things up and they're all safe and ready to go, you know, there's a potential profit for you to make. And so I think by creating this competition within a government-owned system, which is very hard to do, I think that really worked out, and Bruce has become a great success story as a result of that.
Can you explore again a little bit why, or if you're aware, why did the safety culture go to shit? Why did things get so grim? Because that's massive. I mean, after Fukushima, like they shut down everything, and this came at a major cost in terms of the energy. People like fetishize energy conservation, but there's evidence that thousands of elderly Japanese died in heat waves because there were just not enough electricity to go around. You know, and the cost to Japan of importing fossil fuels to replace that nuclear fleet, I think it's tens or even 100 billion, in terms of, I don't know if it was per year, but it's an enormous number. So there must've been an economic sacrifice to doing that, but it was felt necessary. So what went so wrong? Was it underinvestment? Was it, you know, just.
It's hard to know. And I think you would have to talk to some of the old timers that were there at the time to see how things had changed, because it's not like concerns around nuclear safety just emerged in Fukushima. I mean, we have Three Mile Island in 1979. We have Chernobyl in 1986. This is 1997, right? We do know there was an awful lot of turmoil around Ontario Hydro and the nuclear facilities in the early 1990s under the Ray government. Ray comes in there, there is a recession, but they also come in with an anti-nuclear attitude, as unfortunately too many NDP people have. And so there was all this stopping and starting of Darlington. They put some activists on the board of Ontario Hydro. Whether that was a contributing factor or not, whether it was just lackadaisical safety culture, because we've been doing this for 25 years without a problem. You know, it's like people making home renovations, you know, and modifications. Well, you start off small, but 25 years later, it starts to look very different than the design that you had. So I would speak to some of the old Ontario Hydro people, if they're still around, or around what happened, but there was clearly a cultural problem that had emerged. And while the unions and management seem to be on much better page right now. They're both celebrating the refurbishment of Pickering B. That was not the case in the 1990s, and there was a lot more hostility between management and the unions, and that may have also been a contributing factor.
Right, right. Interesting. I mean, certainly nuclear is a high-risk sector. I always make the comparison to aviation, and Boeing really seems to have been going to shit in the last little while. Sounds like for organizational reasons in terms of change in management and different approach. So certainly these industries are vulnerable to...
Aviation is a good comparison because people don't count how many times a plane takes off and lands. You count when it doesn't land. And it's the same thing. You can have a power plant. That's why we talk about, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, and Fukushima. The fact that we can remember them shows how rare a nuclear accident actually is compared to, let's say, a coal mine or a pipeline. But when it happens, it's big, just similar to aviation. So that's a very accurate comparison.
Let's shift gears a little bit to talk about exports. We're going to talk later about, again, technology selection, the Darlington B, that aborted process. But something that the Canda reactor gave us was the IP and the ability to export. There's been the French, imported Westinghouse reactors and indigenized them and got the IP. As recently as the early 2000s, the Chinese negotiated with Westinghouse and got the IP for the AP1000, and now they're creating the CAP, 1000 and 1400, which are essentially derivatives of that. I don't think Canada would have been in a position, a big enough country, a strong enough sector to bargain with the Americans and say, hey, give us the IP. Anyway, we had the IP. What did we do with it in terms of exports? It's an unlikely story that we were competing with the big boys.
Oh, absolutely. And that's where my interest in nuclear energy came from. Was as part of Canadian foreign policy. And that's why the first book is about our exports and how we did about it. And it was recognized early on just how tough a fight Canada was going to be in. Because if you look at who the other nuclear exporting companies or countries were, it was the biggest countries in the world. And so, yeah, we're a G7 country. But we were the seventh of the G7 countries. We're going head to head with the Americans and the Russians in the early years, and then the French and the Japanese start to come on side. So they're also because of the nature, both in cost, the types of technology, and its military applications. The Soviets weren't going to import American technology. The Americans weren't going to import Soviet technology. The French weren't going to, all of this stuff. There was huge, huge trade protectionism. And there is Canada with a Crown Corporation going up against General Electric and Westinghouse, two of the largest companies in the world with the full backing of the United States. So it was very difficult for Canada to penetrate. The fact that we did as much to the Indians, to the Pakistanis, to the South Koreans, to the Romanians, to the Argentines, to the Chinese, I think is a testament to the technology that we had. There was an acknowledgement, maybe not today, but definitely in the 60s and 70s, that the CANDU was a real quality, powerful reactor, quite possibly better than the light water reactors that GE and Westinghouse were delivering. But the extra political baggage that went with them hindered our ability to sell. And it's similar to the old Beta versus VCR battles, back in the day. Initially, Beta was considered the much better technology. VCRs took over the market, and that was it for Beta. And that's why we often talk about Beta, Betamax today. And so it was those political concerns. And so the fact that we achieved as much as we did, that still has an impact today. So there is now an investment. Romania is now building an extra two CANDUs. We still have the intellectual property. We've done refurbishments, in Argentina. And the South Koreans, we sold numerous reactors to the South Koreans, and the South Koreans are now their own exporters. So we kind of lost that.
So, you know, I've been trying to understand our current situation and, you know, the political landscape. You know, the Conservative Party is pretty regionalized. I mean, rural Canada across the country, but, you know, it's certainly, you know, it's a Western party. And I think they tend to represent areas that are natural resource rich, thinking of, you know, oil and gas, mining, et cetera. And then you have kind of central Canada, you know, not that we're laggards in terms of natural resource development in Ontario, Quebec, but, you know, these are real manufacturing hubs. And in terms of the kind of policies that are required to develop each of these sectors, it strikes me that in more of a kind of oil and gas natural resource sector, if you can deregulate, maybe offer more competitive royalties, private business will come in and sort of take care of themselves and exploit your resource. And, you know, hopefully you get a nice chunk of it to do things for the country. But in the high tech sector, particularly as a small nation, conservative politics, particularly sort of, maybe I don't want to say neoconservative, but, you know, the more recent conservative politics are very sort of free market fundamentalist, very averse to what I've heard described as mercantilism of, you know, supporting a national player. But it seems like that's what's required. And I'm guessing that's what was required in terms of these exports across the world.
Absolutely. You know, and we had a lot more crown corporations, you know, back in the 50s and 60s. It started under Mulroney, where we started to privatize the crowns. But prior to then, it was because we were a small country trying to compete with others, and it was access to capital and a feeling that private industry in a country this small, despite being rich, but we didn't see ourselves competing against New Zealand or Sweden or Ireland. We were competing against the United States. And that, I think, required a crown corporation. That didn't mean that there weren't private businesses that support it. There's a huge private nuclear component area in Ontario. But the design area was a crown corp, just as we saw in many other sectors, whether that was rail, whether that was aerospace. And you make the comparison with Bombardier, you know, a private firm, but had to rely heavily on government subsidies. And I would, I don't have the actual figures, but I often joke it's got to be the most subsidized private company in Canadian history. That's kind of where we were. So The conservative government's relationship with nuclear is really interesting, because you look at where nuclear is: St. John, New Brunswick, Durham Region, Bruce County, Chalk River, Ontario. They've always been represented by conservative MPs. But the Harper government, I think, to be fair to the Harper government, when they were in office, every time nuclear hit the news, it was a bad news story. You know, whether that was the problems over isotope production at Chalk River, whether that was, you know, the sticker shock of the new build costs in Ontario, they just wanted out. They just wanted out, and so they sold off the reactor division of AECL to SNC-Lavalin. Even though it would be interesting if Mulroney hadn't spun off the isotope business from AECL, you know, back in the late 80s, early 90s, if AECL would have been a more profitable company after that. They seemed to take, you know, the stuff that could make money and pull it away, and then complain why the existing companies still needed investment. And that whole arrangement remains quite complicated, because it appeared that when SNC-Lavalin initially got the contracts and got the IP at a very, very low cost, that they simply saw it as a reactor repair company, you know, and that their business was going to be refurbishment, not advancing the CANDU design and doing a new build. I think they believed that new builds were gone and that they were just going to be in this business for 30 or 40 years to keep some of them running.
No, I mean, that's certainly interesting. You know, I've had analysts on who tell me, you know, listen, a lot of reactor builds are loss leaders, but what you lock in are long-term fuel and maintenance contracts, which ultimately are the basis of the business. And with the ways that we've seen new builds spiral out of control in the West, particularly in the 21st century, it's not surprising that a company might just want to get that low risk, high return, steady income. And the CANDU offers that with our regular refurbishments. You go ahead and respond to that, but there's so many strings
in
that.
You see that in Ontario right now. I mean, you look at the Ford government and its decisions around, and actually began under Wynne and McGuinty, but around refurbishment, right? Instead of building new reactors, how about we take our existing reactors and just let them operate much longer? This isn't the case of, you know, a 10-year-old car trying to get an extra 5 miles out of it or 5 years out of it. I would compare it to a home, you know, that might be 50 or 60 years of age, but is still structurally sound. It just needs a new furnace. It just needs some new plumbing. And we know that the front end costs of nuclear are at the beginning. So the longer you can keep the thing running, the more economic it is. And so I think that's the Wynn and Ford government should be thankful that they already had these existing plants, that their decision was just about keeping them open. And even in Quebec now is reconsidering its refurbishment of Gen T2.
Absolutely. Yeah. There are so many threads to tug on here, and I'm going to try and artfully find a way to do that because there's so much of interest. But I think the most natural place to go to is that selling off of the reactor division of AECL. And we need to explore that a little bit more. I understand there were a number of countries that were interested. There's even potential interest and I think paranoia from some of the nuclear industry and the unions in particular that a competitor nation like Areva might buy it just to kill it, to get rid of a competitor. That's interesting that yeah. Canada could even be a competitor in that regard against such a big country.
Areva was they were lurking. Yeah. There is no doubt about that. Areva wanted access to that. And I think the Harper government realized if they were going to privatize this, they had to privatize it Canadian, because I think there would have been a public backlash as well as a scientific backlash had they gone to a foreign competitor. But I think that was a real threat at the time that this might be taken over by Areva in particular.
So who were the bidders eventually and what were the bids and who won? And, you know,
I mean, this is
an extraordinary story. Like I think cumulatively in the history of Canada's nuclear sector, I don't know how you do the economic calculations, but we're talking tens or maybe even $100 billion invested over the length of our nuclear program to develop this reactor technology. So you'd think it would sell for a pretty penny.
And it wasn't. It was about $15 million to SNC-Lavalin. And, you know, SNC-Lavalin was a nuclear company, had been involved for decades, large, powerful company. They've gone into disrepute over the last couple of years on numerous scandals, but they were a likely target. The other would have been a consortium of non-SNC, but it's how they changed it, because you've got this company that does R&D, that does reactor designs, that has liabilities, that has assets, but they hived off the reactor division company and left the lab. And so even though the lab is what we call a GoPro, it's government.
You're talking AECL here. You're talking about AECL, yeah. not SNC it right now. You're talking AECL. Okay, two divisions. Chalk River.
So what they did is they hived off the reactor division, sold that off, privatized that, but they kept the R&D and the labs. And even though it's now privately operated, it's still government owned. And some of that is legacy. So we often talk about nuclear waste as spent fuel. The Chalk River site has some areas you don't really want to go around, and no one's going to take those assets over. And so that's why the government had to stay involved. Plus, they were concerned that the private companies were not going to do the R&D that was required. And so they got that off their plate. But in looking back now, 10 years later, maybe 15 years later, what the Harper government was able to do is get rid of all these bad problems. And the bad problems that all existed in the early 2010s around the privatization, around the refurb in Point Lepreau, around the isotopes, around the NRU reactor, those stories are all gone now. And I think that then led the Band-Aid was peeled off. The scab was gone. Now the scab is healed, and it's allowed the nuclear industry to do the multi-billion-dollar refurbishments and the exploration, the serious exploration of SMRs. So it's been a transformation.
Here's the crazy thing in the context of us now having a potential new large build happening at Bruce. I understand Bruce Power was the other entity that was interested in buying the reactor division of CANDU. Obviously, we wouldn't have a technology selection if Bruce had bought CANDU. But just tell me, why did that fall through? Because they were going to pony up a lot more money than SNC, I believe.
Yeah, and I don't know what happened with Bruce. I don't know. Again, because these are commercial agreements, there is a lot. So they would lay out options. You know, the publicly available documents laid out options, but they never talked about the different bids that they received. Those have all been sealed. And so I don't know what pulled Bruce out. I know at that time, TransCanada, which was one of the investors in Bruce, left and they pulled out their investment. Whether that was all linked to those bad times, I don't know. But that would have been a very interesting decision had they gone Bruce instead of SNC, especially given what has happened to SNC since that sale.
So we did this beautiful, we've been making a lot of connections between nuclear and aviation with the Avro Aero, with the safety culture. But I'd like to make one more. And that is with the C-Series Bombardier jet, which I understand is a far superior model to what Airbus and Boeing had on hand in terms of fuel efficiency for a, I believe, a mid-size passenger jet. And ultimately, I think for very similar reasons, you know, this is probably a true Canadian story in terms of over and over again, we see this happening, was sold off for a song to Airbus. I'm not sure how familiar you are with that story, but do you think that's a good analogy to what happened to CANDU? I know they were sold off not to a national player, but do you see any similarities or lessons learned there?
Oh, absolutely. And I would say less about the selling off of the CANDU reactor division as opposed to the spinning off of the isotope business that had occurred a decade prior that has gone on to do very well. Right. And had that remained as part of AECL, who knows how life would have turned out.
You're
not selling off Bombardier, you're selling off one possible profitable right. aspect of it. And that's where I would make that comparison.
I guess the comparison I'm trying to make is you have this an excellent, amazing technology, superior jet. But maybe your country is too small in terms of like this maybe would be analogous to the export issue and Canada's struggle to export CANDU is an ultimate success to do it. But I guess there wasn't the gumption there and the idea that Bombardier could compete with the big boys would have enough endurance to be able to give buyers the certainty that they'd be around to do maintenance, et cetera. So ultimately, they were bought off by a larger company. I'm interested in that sort of export side of it. Again, I'm not sure if you have that.
I would agree with that. In fact, I would say it was even tougher from Bombardier. There's a fascinating case study of the battles that they were having with Embraer, the Brazilian company. And there was a World Trade Organization decision involving Air Wisconsin, of all places. And both companies were trying to sell to Air Wisconsin these mid-sized jets, and both of them were heavily subsidizing one another. So again, we weren't just dealing with Airbus and Boeing. Now we're dealing with Embraer because we're now seeing the rise of Brazil, you know, which has 250 million people versus our 40. So, yeah, similar challenges. It's not always the technology. It's all the extra weight that you can put around those export opportunities, the salesmanship and the marketing and et cetera.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a leading question here, but it'll be interesting only because you're going to probably flesh it out a bit. But in the context of, you know, advanced engineering, high technology, you know, coming out of a variety of different types of countries, different sizes, is there such thing as a free market there when they're competing with one another, or do governments always end up backing? Because I get this impression that there's an element within, you know, the Canadian, I'm not talking about the political spectrum or that this is partisan, but just there's a political tradition. Maybe it's a relatively new one that says we shouldn't back national champions, because, you know, the market should decide and whatever best will happen, and that'll provide best value to consumers down the road. That certainly, I think, conflicts with, you know, some more traditional conservative values, but I'm just trying to sort that out and understand it better.
Outside of elaborate econometric models that economists do, the free market doesn't exist. We've got all sorts of government regulations that are put in place. You look at foreign investment, and yes, we're attracting foreign investment, but there's usually conditions and strings attached to that. You're looking at corporate dollars going into private business. Look at the EV battery plants in Windsor. So the free market does not exist. There's different degrees of government intervention and different types of government intervention. And all countries have that. There's no ideal type pure socialist system anymore, and there's no ideal type capitalist system. It's all various forms of government intervention, whether that's through antitrust, whether that's through tax and subsidies, whether that's through regulation, whether that's investment rules.
Okay. I guess we'll finish on the export topic, and then we're going to jump into this technology selection issue. One of the interesting parts from the politics of Candu exports was how close Canada came to selling Candus to Japan. That would have been consequential for a variety of reasons, obviously for economic reasons. Fukushima probably wouldn't have happened because Candus can cool themselves for about 7 days with thermal siphoning through the flooded steam generators. We'll leave that question of the accident aside, but what went on there? We had these amazing successful bids in China, South Korea, Argentina, et cetera.
Just the role that the GE and the American government had in Japan. And you also have to look at that time period. This is the 1970s. This is post-OPEC. And this is when we start to see the massive amounts of Japanese auto exports going into the United States. Because now, because of their small country and because gasoline was so expensive, they developed fuel-efficient vehicles. So they were able to have these fuel-efficient vehicles that the big three were too late to come to the table with. And so you've got that going on. Now you've got a desire of major American firms trying to sell nuclear energy to Japan. You also have a massive American military presence in Japan. And you've got pressure coming from the Reagan administration over these auto things. There was no way Canada was going to win. Canada came close. Canada had a good bid. Canada had a good reactor. And you think, well, what does autos have to do with nuclear energy? A lot. It would have been tough to imagine how Canada would have won in that fight.
Okay, well, let's pivot in the time we have left to talk about this question of technology selection. When I read your book, there were so many echoes from what's going on now back to that bidding process at Darlington B for the licensed capacity there, which still exists, but is now being used for SMRs. So help me paint the picture of what was going on there. And I want to explore a little bit of how that unfolded and the politics of how that unfolded, et cetera.
So prior to that time in Ontario, there had never been a bidding process. You were going to build a reactor, you were going to build a CANDU. It was that simple. But Ontario decided that they wanted a competitive bid process. And so then you've got Areva coming in, you've got Westinghouse coming in. Both of those were being aided and abetted through export financing from their governments. But because ACL was in Canada, they were not eligible for any export financing. Had ACL been trying to go to Argentina, they would have been eligible for export financing. So you have a situation where Ontario is creating, for its own provincial political purposes, a bidding contest because they're looking for a competitive price. But the Canadian company, the Canadian champion, is running at an unlevel playing field to the foreign competitors. And there was, and so you get this fight going on between the Ontario government, which owns, which would have owned the reactors, and the federal government, which owned AECL. And we didn't see that when Pickering was built. We didn't see that when Darlington was built. There was close collaboration between the Ontario government and the Canadian government and AECL and Ontario Hydro, but not when 2010 came around. And so we've got issues of federalism. We've got issues of competing needs and expectations. And you're dealing with foreign competitors who have greater assets to play because of the nature of the market that they were delivering into. And so
there's something very unique about Canadian nuclear history and the Canada reactor. And we actually didn't touch upon this part. But you know, when we're talking about energy security and price security, there was also an element of manufacturability and fueling security. So, you know, we went with pressure tubes. We couldn't make heavy forgings for the pressure vessel. We went with natural uranium because we didn't want to rely on others for enriched uranium. And the side effect of that is this hyper-localized supply chain. And I'm not sure if it's unique. I'm trying to think about the Russian or Chinese nuclear sectors. They're probably big enough that they do have a, you know, 88 to 96% sort of in-country supply chain. But certainly within the West now, nuclear has become, you know, a multinational endeavor, and supply chains span the world. And there's heavy forgings in Japan or in Korea at Doosan, and modules being made in Czechia, I think. There's something special about the Canadian reactor design being all Canadian. Economic benefits, GDP, tax revenues. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that fit into the
well, and assisting the manufacturing sector as a whole? So you've got companies that may do nuclear business, but they can have spin-off products that go into other commercial entities. This allows for export opportunities and a whole variety of things. So, yeah, the whole supply chain link is a really critical importance, because the days of any product, whether that's a car or an Apple Watch or a television, all being manufactured with all the IP and all the components from one country, those are long gone. And it is, really is a globalized market, which is both an opportunity for Canadian firms as well as a threat for Canadian firms. And some of the stuff, as you're correct, are just so specialized that I feel that we've lost some of that capacity.
Can you expand upon that? What sort of capacity has been lost?
Well, some of those heavy forages, you know, you start to lose that capacity if you're not building, if you're not rebuilding, right?
My understanding was we didn't have the heavy forging, so we went with this pressure tube design because we could manufacture that locally. Yeah.
I'm moving a bit further away from my area, but obviously supply chain is critical here.
For sure.
And it's now become an international supply chain.
Yeah. Yeah. In terms of, again, the politics of how that played out, I understand that AECL and maybe SNC at the later part of the bidding process, they were sort of forbidden from talking about that question of local economic development. Was that something that was still a consideration? And again, with this current bid, we don't know who the owner of the reactors at Bruce will be. Was it clear then that OPG would be the owners and were doing the tech selection, or was the government of Ontario involved in the tech selection?
Because this was aimed at Darlington, that would have been OPG and the Ontario government. It's always been clear that the Ontario government will own things. What the agreement is with Bruce is as an operator. So my guess is Bruce will operate these reactors. They'll be owned by OPG, which is owned by the Ontario government. Then the question becomes, okay, if that's the arrangement, who makes the call on the technology, the owner or the operator? The idea, I guess, is that they would both come to an agreement. But what if they don't? You know, who has the final thumb? I don't know. I mean, these are questions to discuss, you know, on the same sort of, yeah.
In your book, you talk a lot about the kind of anti-nuclear and pro-nuclear coalitions. I'm much more interested in the pro-nuclear ones for obvious reasons. But in terms of this question of that coalition that came together in Darlington and will likely come together around the Bruce bid, you know, in talking to some of my union friends, when it comes to the SMR technology that's been selected at Darlington, it's an American-style boiling water reactor, enriched fuel. You know, they're really alarmed because they say, listen, you know, the crews that are going to come and swap out the fuel and manage the outages of a boiling water reactor will be specialized crews from the U.S. They manage, I'm not sure if it's 30 or 40 of those reactors. They just go around from reactor to reactor all year long, and they're amazing at it. That's why U.S. has some of the highest capacity factors in the world. And so it wouldn't make any economic sense for Canadians to do that work. And so they're seeing a chunk of potential work disappearing. And, you know, if we have a American style reactor as a smaller one to fit with maybe Alberta, Saskatchewan, and other provinces, and an American style reactor for our larger needs, one can imagine there's going to be sacrifices of, again, large chunks of the existing Canadian supply chain, whether that's fueling, whether that's engineering services that support troubleshooting the CANDU reactor. How did that play out during the 2009 bidding process?
Yeah, so when we talk about these coalitions, what unites the pro coalition is a whole series of belief systems around the importance of nuclear energy and the value that brings. But then you see breaks within the coalition when it comes down to commercial interests. So, you know, you can have three different companies all agree the importance of nuclear, all working together to get nuclear. Now they're competing for a design, and then that starts to break things down. And the SMR decision was, I think, so critical because they were first. And the only way SMR makes monetary sense is to build a fleet, not to have a series of one-offs. So when Ontario made the decision to go to GE Hitachi, well, guess what? Now Saskatchewan is going GE Hitachi. And Alberta hasn't made a design, but the relationship between OPG and Capital Power, and OPG has already made the decision around GE Hitachi, you can see where this is going, at least on the SMRs. Well, now we've got a traditional reactor project going on in Bruce. Do you go with a different design, an updated CANDU design for the traditional and a different design for the SMRs, right? These are some of the questions that I think are going to be posed. I don't think we can have any answers now, but that's where the questions are going to be. Just as it didn't make sense in Canada in the 60s to have more than one reactor design, I don't think it makes sense at an SMR level to have more than one reactor design, but can you have different designs for a 700,000 megawatt reactor versus a 250, 300 megawatt reactor? Those are some really interesting economic, technological, manufacturing, political types of questions. And you're not going to get unanimity on that.
I'm going to have to quote Britney Spears here and say, oops, I did it again. I've pulled you from Alberta and we focused almost exclusively on Ontario. So I apologize to my Western Canadian.
No, that's fine. I mean, that's the audience. Heart of the industry.
But I think, you know, we don't have time to sort of go through each province as your book did. And I'd encourage listeners to buy the book and invest in some duct tape to fix the binding. You know, I think there are some interesting themes. You covered Alberta, Saskatchewan, Ontario, New Brunswick. Obviously, Quebec has a nuclear program. But I think what's really interesting is, you know, we've got these hydropowers, whether it's Manitoba, Quebec, and BC. I mean, what I used to say were inexhaustible hydroelectric potential. And so why would they ever go nuclear? But, you know, as you mentioned with Quebec, they're talking about potentially bringing that mothballed CANDU back online. There's some whisperings in BC, and they're trying to investigate, you know, these very ambitious climate goals that are going to require significant growth in their grid, and they're struggling with drought. We don't usually, you know, are very quick to understand that wind and solar are intermittent and weather dependent, but hydro is, I guess, climate dependent. And we've seen some major issues with droughts across the country this year that have affected output. So maybe let's talk a bit about those hydroelectrically.
Yeah, I mean, provinces. there was a major press conference yesterday in Alberta where they're saying we're at a stage four level of drought. Stage five is they have to bring in a national emergency. So they're very worried about drought coming in the summer. And so is the BC government. And so is the Manitoba government. And so is the Quebec government, not about agriculture and water supply, but their electricity supply. Because of hydro. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the Gen T2 refurbishment is back on the table. That's been a political football for a decade. It is clear that Hydro-Québec wants to restart it. The Quebec government does not. But this may now be forcing their hand. And the BC government, the very fact that BC is even saying the word nuclear without spitting afterwards, I think tells you the concern that they're having. So of those places, I think Quebec is much more likely because they have the existing facility. And it would be similar to what they did with Bruce and Pickering A back in the day. You know, they're saying, well, it's been 10 years. Yeah, well, it was about 10 years that they restarted the Bruce reactor. So I think that's the parallel that they have there. But really, I think you're back to Alberta, Saskatchewan, Ontario, and New Brunswick. Ontario obviously has the most activity, but there is some serious stuff going on out in the prairies, much more serious than even back in 2010. So, and the connection I'm making is that agreement, feasibility study between OPG and Capital Power, that's big. Because they're not talking about the oil sands. This isn't the Pathways Alliance. This is a large, privately owned electricity generating company in Alberta thinking about putting it directly on the grid and linking themselves up with OPG, you know, who owns the reactors, been operating the reactors. So that's not just a couple guys in a room. These are big players.
Absolutely. I guess in closing, you know, as we mentioned in terms of the early deployments in Ontario, Japan, France, et cetera, you know, these were driven by the energy security imperative. You know, there's certainly a lot of talk about doubling or tripling our grid due to, you know, climate-driven goals of electrification. I think those are all well and good, but again, maybe it's the pessimist in me. I think it's easy to talk and set goals and make commitments. It's easy to build, you know, wind farms and solar farms. Those are highly constructible, highly modular projects, you know, and I guess with a lot of public support and a good narrative behind them. Nuclear is, again, it's the hardest of hardwares. It's very tricky. It requires exceptional levels of institutional maturity, incredible human resources, and those are dwindling at times demographically. And so I'm wanted to get your thoughts, because it seems like that key driver of energy security is potentially not there. I mean, Alberta is awash in oil and gas, Saskatchewan as well. You know, BC, I'm not so sure. Maybe they'll be more climate driven. But I guess just in closing, the climate talk versus the energy security imperative, is there sufficient energy security imperative there to drive these provinces to do the incredibly technically difficult, financially difficult thing of building nuclear?
It's not just about energy security. It really is climate. And it is the recognition that they have to scale down emissions. And so the debate in Alberta, it's not about nuclear replacing the oil sands. It's about nuclear aiding and helping the oil sands drive down its emissions costs, because those are long-term 20, 30, 50, 60-year debates, as opposed to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, you know, which hopefully will be over soon, and the effects that that has on energy security. I still think it is the climate debate. That is not going away. Investors, insurance companies, even if you get rid of the consumer carbon tax, as Pauly Ebb is promising, there's still going to be work being done at the industrial level. And so what has changed, I think, is not is the realization, at least here in Alberta, of the big energy companies that nuclear is not a competitor. It's an aid. It's a help. It's an assistance that they can work together. And I think that's something that has changed.
Do you see, I mean, we're certainly seeing the farmers' protests in Europe. We had the yellow vest some time ago. You know, when it comes down to an affordability crisis, you know, climate does take the back seat when people are surveyed and said, how much money would you put per year into fighting climate change? It's like $100 or less. I'm just, you know, in my pessimistic anticipation, perhaps, of further economic hardship or recession, et cetera, you know, Robert Bryce and I think Roger Pilkey talk about this iron law of electricity, that in the end, you'll use any fuel, you'll burn anything to get the electricity that you need. Obviously, it's lovely if it can be carbon free. And I'm a climate hawk. But again, I'm a little bit of a cynic. Like, are we seeing a rollback in ESG? Are we going to see a rise of, you know, governments in Europe that are more on the political right and are saying, hey, these green energy policies have been disastrous. We're deindustrializing. We're losing business, and a kind of whiplash and backlash against climate action. Do you think that's on the horizon? And do you think that would affect, again, a climate imperative for nuclear?
That is an effect, but in Europe. In the case of Canada, and I would also say in Europe, it's what I would call the direct cost versus the indirect cost. And I often use the comparison of the GST. The GST caused a firestorm when it was introduced.
This is the goods and sales tax for my international
listeners. Yeah, the goods and sales tax. Yeah. But it replaced a much worse indirect tax. But because it was now visible, consumers realized it and rebelled. Same thing with the carbon tax. We'd had an industrial carbon tax in Alberta since the Stelmach days in 2006, 2007. The Kenney government, which railed against the consumer carbon tax in this province, increased the industry carbon tax. So I think we need to separate the indirect to direct. So yeah, I think the consumer tax is under great strain in Canada. Clearly, Pauly Ebb's axe the tax message is resonating. You'll notice he doesn't talk about industry, right? He doesn't. So that's a separate thing. And it's because even if it's worse, if it's not in your face, it's the less of a concern to you. It's those visible policies that you can see and touch that those lead to the backlashes. And you're dealing with the professionals, the scientists, the engineers who really know this stuff, know what is coming as opposed to the mass public when you're talking about industry levels and regulation levels. So I'm a bit more optimistic on that side. I share your pessimism about the consumer carbon. But I'm more bullish that we'll still see work on climate at the industry level.
Interesting. Okay. Dr. Bratt, I could talk to you all afternoon, but it's been a pleasure, and maybe that means we'll have to have you come back. It's been fascinating to get the analysis of a political scientist on a technical issue, to be able to chat about, you know, export and economic nationalism and all these other things. And I'm looking forward to having you in my network to be able to bounce ideas off. So thank you for being so generous with your time. And thank you for coming on
Decoupled. Okay. Thanks, Chris.